Accession number 27177, Real 1.
Captain Tony Swainson, Real 1.
I'm Anthony Swainson. I'm 82 years of age. I was born on the 29th of October 1921 at a place called Little Common near Bexhill in Sussex. My father was an impoverished schoolmaster, and we used to live in a little two-up, two-down called The Nook at number 11 Churchill Avenue. Nothing to do with Churchill, but it was the hill that went to the church, which was St. Mark's, where I was christened. My father used to go up to London every day. He used to cycle. He called it a push bike. I don't know why they call it a push bike, but he used to cycle from Little Common to Sidley Station and catch the train up to Charing Cross, where he was a teacher. I grew up in Little Common, then we moved to Bexhill. All right, where are we going? School, cricket? I'll have my hand up to stop, will I? When I want to start formulating my ideas again. Okay.
That's all right.
After Bexhill, I went to school locally, and learnt my lovely game of cricket and football and everything else. Enjoyed sport immensely, and I eventually got a nomination to Christ Hospital at Horsham in Sussex, where of course it was known as the Blue Coat School, where we wore these wonderful uniforms with bright yellow stockings and little trousers. And unfortunately, after a certain while, I left Christ Hospital because my father got a job in London, so they wanted me in London, and I went to Colley Court, which was the prep school for St. Paul's. And Colley Court was a famous place where Webber and Tim Rice wrote their first song, first stage performance. I then went to St. Paul's, which is opposite Colley Court, where again I played cricket and rugby and enjoyed myself immensely. My father couldn't keep me there for very long, so I found myself working in the city in an insurance company in the claims department of C.E. Heath, who are now very big insurance brokers, I gather, until the war broke out. And of course we were living then in barns, and we spent our life in the Anderson shelter, which was a shelter that was built, provided by the Home Minister called Anderson, which was built and put in, we had to put it in the garden, and we spent the night there every night because of the air raids. The air raids in London in the 1940 were horrific, and indeed one night I was sitting in the shelter and I said to my mother that I could smell burning, and I was told to shut up and go to sleep, and sure enough a stick of incendiary bombs had come across the roof of our house and the whole thing was on fire. And I might add that the firemen made more mess than the fire, I think. However, I was only too pleased when I was eventually called up and I had to go down to Plymouth. Actually, it was HMS Raleigh, according to taste of pronunciation. And it was a seaman's training establishment at Tor Point in Cornwall. This was in July 1941 when I had to go and join the forces to defeat our friend Adolf Hitler. Now, HMS Raleigh was a seaman's training establishment. It was a 12-week course. There was no shore leave for 6 weeks. We were a complete mixture. There were Glaswegians, there were Liverpudlians, and there were posh people like me. We were there to learn all the naval nomenclature of going ashore, being on board. Beds were called bunks. The floor was called a deck. The ceiling was a bulkhead. The ceiling was a deckhead, and the walls were called bulkheads. And we learned seamanship. We learned knots and splices and bends and hitches. And we learned the rules of the road, how a ship conducts itself at sea, and the various parts of ship, the forecastle, the mainsail, and so on. And we had bromide in our tea, I might add, which for obvious reasons. Physical training was a great, a lot of emphasis was put on physical training. We were kicked out of our bunks at about 6 in the morning, whether there was snow on the ground or not, and doing PT. And of course an awful lot of square bashing ensued, which was marching up and down giving orders. and they were assessing all the time what they called euphemistically our power of command. And we did rifle training. We were shooting with 303s, and I was actually picked for the flying squad because I happened to be a rather good shot. And the great flying squad was supposed to be there to repel Hitler when he invaded, because don't forget we were now really in the threat of invasion. We were a very mixed bag in the barracks, and as I said, all sorts and conditions of men, largely Liverpudlians. There was a huge number of Glaswegians, and they're all pretty rough. And I then was a fairly well brought up chap, and at the age of 19 I used to kneel down at my bedside and say my prayers, and I used to get their boots hurled at me with monotonous regularity, which was rather off-putting actually to one's spirituality. However, getting back to what we were doing with our physical training and our square bashing and rifle training and so on, we were also taught, I suppose one would call it husbandry. We were taught how to wash our clothes, how to iron them, and even how to darn our socks and so on. And we were given a thing called a hussive, spelled housewife, which had a needle and thread and all the rest of it on it. So we were turned out as fairly practical guys. And the amusing thing was to see the photographs at the beginning of our course and at the end, and you just wouldn't recognise anybody. I mean, apart from the fact that we all had short back and sides by the time we'd left, but we looked clean, healthy, well-fed, and I'm sure that those who came from more deprived backgrounds really were looking pretty fit at the end of it all. At the end, when we passed out in November, December 41, I was drafted to Devonport Barracks, which is just adjacent to Torpoint Point, which was the main base of Plymouth, and I was awaiting my first ship, having been qualified as an ordinary seaman. It's a wonderful term.
How did you feel when that happened?
Absolutely thrilled. I was a very ordinary seaman. In fact, there was a book written by an MP at the time, I think, called Very Ordinary Seaman. But there we were, proud as punch, and so pleased to be wearing the uniform as a naval sailor. And we were sitting in Devonport Barracks. I was keen on rugby and cricket, as I mentioned before, and I was playing rugby for Devonport Services one day, and I just before that been drafted to HMS Edinburgh, which was a town class cruiser of about 10,000 tons, a very fine ship. And I remember walking down on the Sunday morning and looking at it and thinking, by Jove, do you realise I'm going to be a member of that ship's company on the Monday? And it was on the Sunday afternoon that I was playing rugby for Devonport Services, and I knocked down somebody punting a ball, and it hit me on the end of my right hand, my fist, and I fractured what is known as a scaphoid, which is one of seven small bones in the wrist, just above the thumb. And it is the most difficult bone to heal. It takes the longest time. So there I was, stop draft, cancelled my appointment to HMS Edinburgh, and I was left on shore on sick duties for 6 months, waiting for this thing to heal with my right hand in plaster. Little did I know that HMS Edinburgh on the Monday sailed, and I didn't know where she was going, but she was going, this came out after the war, to Murmansk, and she was sunk with all hands in the Arctic seas. So that was my first, I suppose, smelling of roses. Came out of it smelling of roses. So I spent 6 months as the Surgeon Captain D's messenger. Surgeon Captain, he was a dental captain. And I used to have to sit on a chair outside his door. And every time he buzzed the buzzer, I came in and said, "Yes, sir." And he would say, "Go and get me some chocolate or some nutty or something from the canteen." And that was all I did. And as I said, I thought rather ruefully at the end of it all. He was a nice old boy, but and spoke to me in very friendly terms, but he never even bothered to look inside my teeth. He might have easily had a look and see that I was dentally fit. So anyway, I spent 6 months hanging around the barracks and was getting very, very bored with the whole scene. I should add that when Edinburgh went down, it transpired that she was carrying a lot of gold bullion, which we were giving to the Russian government. In the spring of 1942, I was sent to, I think it was called HMS St. Christopher. Don't forget, every single establishment, Shaw establishment, had a Her Majesty's Service, His Majesty's Service, as it was then, linked to it. So this was HMS St. Christopher, and it was a coastal forces training base at Fort William on Loch Linney. The weather was beautiful, and it was really a very enjoyable month, where we were taught to handle boats and ship handling and that sort of thing. As a sideline, I right next door to Ben Nevis, Fort William is, and so I decided to climb Ben Nevis, which went very well. I was on my own, and I whizzed up there in about 3 hours, I think. And when I came down, I started glissading down, and I don't know what it was, but just instinctively I thought, I don't like this, I better, and I rolled over and held onto a rock, and about 20 yards in front of me there was a sheer drop. So I would never have got out of Fort William had I gone on glissading down. But there we are, the good Lord was looking after me that day.
Did you have proper climbing gear?
No, I was in naval uniform. Nothing. I mean, I shouldn't really have gone up there, I suppose. However, I qualified as a coxswain, and in April, May, I was sent to Greenhithe in Kent, a little village on the north coast, where they were building, all these little shipyards were turning out ships for the Royal Navy, and this was to commission a rescue motor launch called an RML, which was being built in this shipyard. I can't remember the name of the shipyard, but the RML was a 70-ton boat, and it had a big sick bay, a sort of hut built on the upper deck, and that was to rescue pilots from the drink, and we had a sick berth attendant on board to look after them. There I was, a qualified coxswain, and alas, I was appointed as the ship's cook. Now, as I'd never cooked anything in my life, I was an absolute unmitigating disaster. I even burnt the spuds, and the captain was an Australian, I remember clearly, and all he wanted was a steak for breakfast, which was rather tedious, so I had to cook him a steak every day for breakfast, and the ship's company were very, very fed up with me, and indeed they used to hurl things at me when we were eating and saying, look at this is stale, this is overcooked, and so on. They treated me appallingly, and I had to grow up rather fast as the ship's cook. I didn't learn cooking. I hated cooking. I knew it was 20 minutes for a roast beef, and that's about it. But the only advantage was that when you'd scrubbed out the galley at about 3 in the afternoon and cleaned up and tidied up, your day's work was done, whereas they had to go on a bit longer. Anyway, I survived as the ship's cook, and we went in this RML on the Dieppe raid, which was to pick up pilots out of the drink. And that was my first bit of action. Having done my sea training in this funny little 70-ton boat or ship, hardly call it a ship, but anyway, I was then recommended for officer training and sent to HMS King Alfred, which was, I think it's still called King Alfred, a large place in Brighton. Or was it Hove? I think it's Hove. I went there in October 1942, and I think in January of 43. Well, I remember marching up and down with a fixed bayonet for my 21st birthday, thinking, well, this is one way of celebrating. I was on sentry duty to repel the Germans, who never came, thank God. And in January 1943, I had this huge title of Acting Sub-Lieutenant Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. That was me, Swainson, Acting Sub-Lieutenant RMVR. The lowest form of animal life. I was then appointed as an officer of the Royal Navy, and I was sent to Her Majesty's ship Tormentor, again a shore base at Warsash near Southampton, and I was then trained, and I was to train sailors in handling landing craft, having had my experience up in Scotland.
Would you like to just talk about...
The training method, I suppose, really, was what we were trying to do then, realising that we weren't going to be invaded. We were then thinking of the second front, and therefore all our sailors were being taught how to handle small boats, landing craft, that's to say how to coxswain them, how to come alongside, how to let go, how to deal with the ropes and deal with landing in a seaway, making sure that the boat didn't broach too, that's to say come on sideways onto the beach. So, because we had to produce hundreds and thousands of sailors with landing craft, and they had to be able to handle them to get all the troops ashore successfully for the various invasions which were to follow. There was Torch in North Africa, and of course there was Normandy, and all the ones in Sicily and Italy. And so we were doing an important job in turning out crews for the future invasion of Europe and further afield. Okay. In early 1944, I was switched off this training course and sent with about 10 other guys for a very special briefing, which we didn't know what it was all about, but all we knew was, which was rather frightening, it was behind closed doors and there was a sentry outside to keep everybody at bay. It transpired that we were then being trained to take landing craft over to Normandy with big tanks full of liquid high explosive, which we then pumped into rather like a fireman's hose. We put a charge on it, threw it over the side and beat it, hoping that it would explode and blow up all the mines before the landing. Now, we realized very early on that this was complete suicide. And so we more or less sort of made our wills and said goodbye to everybody. We were thoroughly depressed by this. And we used to practice down at near Bournemouth on the beaches, firing these hoses into the sea. We never filled them up with liquid high explosive, but liquid high explosive was terribly volatile. It would just touch by a bullet, the whole thing would go up in flames. But Montgomery came down to see us doing a final rehearsal one day, and luckily the southwest wind was blowing fairly strongly and all the hoses got intertwined with each other, and he said, stop, we'll kill more of our own troops than the enemy, and he cancelled the whole project. So that really was my next survival effort. So that was the third time I'd survived, because that was a complete job for suicide, finish, kaput. It was the most ghastly and worrying experience, but good old Monty, he stopped it on safety grounds. So now we come to the dreaded invasion of Normandy, which had been planned for so long, and that was why so many of these landing craft chaps were being trained. And I found myself then in command of a rocket ship, I think, which we had to go over before the invasion, virtually. I mean, everybody was behind, all the troops were behind us, but our job was to fire these rockets into the mining area. They had these telemines on long poles on the beaches, and theoretically we were to blow them all up so the troops could land peacefully. Well, of course, I mean, that was a bit of a joke, because we didn't anything like blow them all up, but at least we made the attempt. I was off the beach of Arromanches, Juno Beach, off Arromanches at about 4 o'clock in the morning. But the going over, I'd like to just say, it was an extraordinary experience, because first of all the operation was planned for the 5th of June, and we had this ghastly weather and it blew and blew and blew, and Eisenhower postponed it 24 hours, and then there was just a little window of opportunity, which the Met boys said to him, the 6th of June, go, or otherwise we'll miss the moon and all the rest of it for another 3 weeks. So we had to go on the 6th, and it was still a bit blowy and a bit rough. But we were transported over there in a big merchant ship and then lured about a mile offshore, off the enemy coast, and then we chanted in ourselves. And when we got to the within view of the beach, one could see the whole thing clearly. There were pillboxes, we could see the German flamethrower coming at us. But the drone of our own aircraft overhead was just constant, and it was an enormously comforting thought that our boys were there. And we kept saying, well, where are the enemy? Because they weren't there. There was no enemy aircraft activity. There was just this terrific drone. I suppose it was actually our paratroopers going over. In fact, they were the advanced drop. They were the first chaps to land there. And the other thing was these huge 16-inch, 12-inch shells coming whizzing across us from the battleships and the cruisers, who were firing straight into the beaches to soften up the enemy. And that, all that was going on over our heads. And in a way, as it was all on our side, we felt rather comforted by this and thought, well, that's all right. However, we did realise that there was a danger of hitting these mines as we went in. And my best friend was on my port hand, that's on the left-hand side, and he, in his ship. And alas, he hit one of these mines, which could have happened to any of us. And of course, he went up in a huge cloud of smoke and loud explosion. And one just felt numb, I suppose, thinking, well, there he goes. Oh dear, nothing we can do about it. Get on with the job, Swainson, stop beefing. And which we did. So with more determination, we ploughed in, and there was a German pillbox firing a flamethrower at me, and I fired off my rockets and destroyed the German pillbox, for which I suppose I got this mention in dispatches thing, which was very nice at the end of it all. But then we returned back to the ship, and were only too thankful to get the hell back. And as we got to Southampton, all the bands were playing on the jetty, you know, and it was, "Oh God, our help in ages past." I remember the hymn vividly, and of course tears were streaming down our eyes, really, because we thought we'd been into that little bit of hell and survived. So in 1945/6, after Normandy, it is, we went on with this training for landing craft, because the Sicily landings, the Italy invasion was in hand, and we were training hundreds and hundreds of sailors to handle their craft for that operation. So I was an instructor there, and I quite enjoyed that until 1947, when I was then appointed to what they call general service. In other words, I went to one of Her Majesty's destroyers, HMS, I keep saying Her Majesty, it's his, of course, in those days, HMS Bleasdale, which was a Hunt-class destroyer. They were all named after famous hunts throughout England. There was Cowdrey and Bicester and Bleasdale, and all famous hunts. And every time we went in and out of harbour on a hunting horn, we played a hunting "We Will Go," which was always rather dramatic. But we were based in Sheerness, which is near Chatham, and is a pretty dreary spot, if I may say so. I gather it's greatly improved now. But Sheerness in the winter of 1947, of course, that was the big freeze year, and it was an Attlee government, it was a Labour government, and they imposed a six-month moratorium on all the fleet. No fleet furnace oil, fuel oil, was allowed to be expended, and all ships were, in quotes, grounded, really. And so we just stayed in harbour for the whole 6 months of this ghastly winter. As I say, ice floes came into Sheerness, large icebergs came in to Sheerness Harbour, and we just spent most of our time sitting over a one-bar electric fire in the wardroom, being pretty miserable. However, eventually we were commissioned to sail from Chatham, from Sheerness, and go to Heligoland, as we were the firing ship to blow up Heligoland. Heligoland, as you know, is a German island sitting off the Elbe, and the government had stuffed all the available torpedoes and mines and anything that went bang into Heligoland Island, and the idea was we were going to blow it up. And we were the firing ship. All we had to do was just press the button. And we steamed over there, and that was my first introduction to the media, which was quite interesting, because I was pretty green, and I was put in charge of all the international press who came on board, and they were down in the wardroom, and I was giving them a cup of coffee and some biscuits at about 10 o'clock in the forenoon. And to my amazement, the typewriters were going rat-tat-tat-tat-tat, and blow me down, by 11 o'clock, the story had been written. Flames reached to 30,000 feet and blah, blah, blah. And we weren't actually firing this thing until 1300, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I said to one of these chaps, "You're not going to write all that. It hasn't even happened." And of course they looked at me, you know, it was rather pathetic, "Go away, boy," you know. And one kind chap took me on one side and said, "Look, we do this all the time in the media. He said, when you read an eyewitness account, he said, it's not an eyewitness account. We've written it ours before. And he gave an example, the Queen will be wearing a green dress, a pink dress, or a blue dress, and they just cross out what is inappropriate. And that is how they write these things. So from now on, whenever I see an eyewitness account, I'm always rather cynical about the whole thing. However, the blow did happen at 1300, when we pushed the button, and it was the biggest TNT explosion the world has ever seen. And if anybody is old enough to have seen the headlines and the photograph in the Daily Express of that day, of the next morning, there it was, this fantastic picture of every single bit of high explosive going up. That was pre-nuclear, but it was the biggest TNT explosion the world had ever seen. It was a most dramatic sight, quite awe-inspiring. Do the... In 1948, I think it was, or maybe in the end of 47, we sailed to Wilhelmshaven in HMS Bleasdale, and we didn't really know what our mission was, but we suddenly found ourselves escorting merchant ships to Palestine. And of course, it was in 48 when all the European Jews were populated Palestine against the will of the local Arabs. But to my astonishment, I had a picture of one of the merchant ships. They were all caged in, these Jewish immigrants, and we had our guns trained on the ship all the way to Palestine, and we got them right and saw they got ashore and everything else. And so it's always been a puzzle to me, and someone perhaps could tell me. I thought the Jews went there voluntarily, but by jingo, this lot who we were escorting were press ganged and pushed into Palestine, and the Palestinians were kicked out of their country and the Israelis were moved in. And I thought that was a most astonishing performance. When you're considering, if you're a sailor, to have your mortal remains scattered at sea, I advise you against it, and I'll tell you why. Again, in this good ship HMS Bleasdale, we were commissioned one day to scatter the immortal remains of Admiral so-and-so off Sheerness. And so off we sailed with the mortal remains and the chaplain, who had them in a brown service certificate envelope, which struck me as rather an odd thing to do. But those were the immortal remains of this great admiral. And we steamed out into sufficiently far, and I was in charge of the funeral party on what we call the iron deck by the torpedo tubes, with the sailors with their hats on, their chin stays down and looking suitably funereal. And I was in charge of the funeral party, and the ceremony began. And when the chaplain was to scatter the ashes of this great admiral on the sea, the captain, unbeknown to us, altered course 180 degrees. So to cut a long story short, the whole lot came back inboard, all over us. And we were brushing ourselves down and dusting ourselves down, and we in the end ended up, we had put the hoses on the deck. So my recommendation, anybody wants to be buried at sea, don't. So when I left Bleasdale, I got my, what they call general service watchkeeping certificate. I qualified as a watchkeeper in general service, that's to say in any ships of any size. I was then sent to do a physical training course at the Royal Naval School of Physical Training at Pitt Street in Portsmouth, a very old famous street in Portsmouth. When I qualified there, which was after about 6 months, I suppose, I was then sent as the physical training officer for HMS Vernon, which is an anti-submarine establishment in Portsmouth, a big, big place, where I served for about a year or 18 months, I can't remember which. And it was there that I was offered a permanent commission in the Royal Navy. So I became, from a wavy navy, I became a straight striper, as they call it. And I was then Lieutenant Swainson Royal Navy, as opposed to Lieutenant Swainson Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. But I was thrilled about that because it gave one security and a future, and I loved the Royal Navy and wanted to make a career in that. Whereas many of my chums took what they called a golden bowler after the war to go outside and make lots of loot. This I chose not to so do.